papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people.
And the Media Project is back on the air. Welcome. Thanks for joining us. I'm Ira Fussfeld, the retired publisher of the Daily Freeman of Kingston, New York, and our little Media Projectiles group this week will hopefully provide you some commentary and analysis and insight and humor. And that group includes Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. Good day, Alan.
And good day to you, Ira, and to the rest of the group. You are terrific people.
And the rest of the group includes Judy Patrick, the former longtime editor of the Schenectady Gazette, and now the vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association. Good day, Judy.
Always glad to be here.
And Rosemary Armeo is here, back on the Media Project where she belongs, longtime journalist, specializing investigative journalism. Happy to see you.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, you know, it's hard to start to the program this week without talking about a story that's been headlining the news, but not necessarily specifically the details of that story, but really the media aspect of it. And I'm talking about the Jeffrey Epstein case, the allegations of sexual trafficking, etc. This story has become center stage largely because of the investigative journalism of a reporter named Julie Brown at the Miami Herald. She worked on this story for more than a year. It resulted in a series entitled Perversion of Justice, and she's getting her due. And if you find stories about what this investigation was all about, it really, I would hope, give you some admiration about what journalism can be, what journalists do, and how important and hardworking journalists are. Rosemary, this is your
piece. Here. She'll definitely be a Pulitzer contender for this work. It comes from a long line of work at the Miami Herald on children. So she went back after everyone had given up on it. The government, the prosecutors, all the officials who supposedly are our first line guard against this sort of thing had moved on. And she went back and pulled up 10 years worth of court filings and documents and records of all sorts. She went back and found the victims of Epstein's crimes and talked to them. Talked to them, really some of them for the first time. They had not been listened to by any officials. And she put together a story. I just read it this weekend when Epstein indictment came down. It's powerful. It makes you so angry. It does everything investigative journalism is supposed to, and then had the added benefit of spurring on public officials to do what they should have done in the first place.
But interestingly, this story was published back in November and nothing happened. And she even talks about the fact that she wrote it and then it sits there like a lot of investigative stories do. You write them and then they go into a black hole, seemingly.
Except this one didn't, Judy, because the officials, the prosecutors, Berman in the Southern District of New York cited her work. They actually were using it and following up on it. So you're right, though. Too much stuff just sits and nothing happens.
And you didn't see any politicians calling for Acosta's resignation back in November when this story landed. And I thought, oh, here's another great piece of journalism that's going to go nowhere. Thankfully, the federal prosecutors stepped in. But if they hadn't, again, it's sad that there is a lot of investigative journalism that doesn't get acted on by
our system is set up to work that way. Journalists do not make policy. They do not bring indictments. All they do is set the record straight and call out what happened. And then it does require action by public officials. Watergate worked that way. Name any investigative story that resulted in change. And it worked with politicians following up upon what journalists had found out. But you need both legs of that, both legs of that stool.
But don't you all think that one of the things that is so impressive about this is that it's like watching a great basketball team, Ira the sports guy, you know, passing off to each other. I love the idea that so many journalists who are working for competing news organizations are willing to give this one reporter all that she is due for having done this. And I love that part of this.
Reading the story about how she did this work, it's like reading a script from a movie. You can see the next spotlight. You remember Spotlight, the movie about the Boston Globe? You know, she's quoted as saying it was like an onion. With every record that I got, it was like, I can't believe this. It was just more and more information. I was going to ask Rosemary to put us in the heads of a journalism investigative reporter. Mm-hmm. The patience that one must have to be a journalism investigative reporter, because you're working on a subject and that subject alone for countless months and without seeing anything in print or digitally. Is there a frustration? How hard is it to go through the process?
No, you get so into it that you become crazed. If there's a team of reporters who work on this, this is when actual fistfights break out because you're so invested in this material. And it's just like she said, she gets a document and she realizes, oh my God, I have it. And you're slowly getting people who talk to you and you realize how much you have. And there's a great impulse to publish part of it or a piece of it. And that's where editors come in who have to say, no, 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 sit on this, follow this. What are we going to do next? Wouldn't it be better if we had this before we print it? And then the really frustrating stage comes when you've written it. You've got a draft, and then it has to go through endless editing and lawyering. Line by line, it's called an audit. Every phone number, every spelling of a name is checked in addition to the big facts of the story. And that's when you get most crazed because you just want it out at that point.
So here's the unknowable, as Donald Rumsfeld would say, question. There is, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, fewer and fewer examples of this kind of reporting in this age of financial distress in the newspaper business in particular. If we start from that premise and if we agree with that premise, does something like this become a motivation for institutions to say, this is where we ought to put our resources now? This is something that is unique to us if we put our minds to it. Or is it just going to be, you know, it's a shame that there aren't more of these, but we just can't afford to have these kinds of stories anymore?
That's what happens. It's a money decision. But, you know, the truth, Ira, is that there is never, even in the heyday of investigative reporting, it was never the majority of reporting. There would be, at best, a small team at a major newspapers that could afford the reporting power. You know, Julie Brown is not cheap. She's a really, really great reporter, and she's going to get top dollar. That's not a lot for newspaper reporters, but still the highest salary. It requires lawyers. It requires travel. It requires going all over to look for documents and to meet with sources. It's very expensive. And of course, look at the stakes. This went her way, but what if she had made some small error that wasn't caught? She'd be subject to the worst kind of legal action. So no, I don't see this advancing. What will happen is that kids will be inspired. Mm-hmm. There are really bright students still showing up at journalism schools because they see this as important and want to do it. But we don't have the business model worked out yet to get this into the public.
You know, I'd love to ask Judy this question, this very question, because she's a great panelist, as we all know, but also she was the editor of a major newspaper. And people want to know those basketball scores, and they want to know what happened at a school board meeting. And this business of the editor having to make this decision is really a tough one.
It is a tough one, and in fact, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about Vanity Fair, and they had an article ready to go on this very same topic, and their references to the sex trafficking were stripped from the story, and right now that editor is being criticized, the editor saying that they didn't have enough, they didn't feel confident in the reporting. So it's a classic example of when the amount of investigative reporting that's needed, the bravery of the publication to go forward with the content, because it takes a certain amount of courage to do these kind of stories. So you've got to protect, as we always say, you got to protect the masthead.
And wasn't there a point in the Watergate story, as I remember it, where they got one little thing wrong and they became subjected to, you know, the whole Nixonian attack because of one small fact?
Yeah,
I mean, that was famously in All the President's Men. I forget which, might have been Magruder, gave them a signal, them, Woodward and Bernstein, and they misinterpreted the signal and ran the wrong story and then had to correct it. But as Rosemary points out, if you make a mistake in the middle of something like this, it will be used to throw the entire thing in doubt. And that happens, frankly, we see that with Trump. It happens every day of the week now. Anytime there's a mistake in a story, it's an example to those who don't want to believe us of the universal incompetence of the media.
Yeah, well, CNN will apologize, for example, for an error, which is exactly what a news outlet should do when an error is made. And Trump uses that as proof that there's nothing but fake news and incompetence.
You know, in the NXIVM trial, which I suppose everybody knows about by now, but was covered very well by the Albany Times Union and other papers, but the Albany Times Union did a terrific job. And a recent story was that the NXIVM people were making an enemies list, basically, of people who they didn't like, who they could go after. And I'm sure there were lots of reporters on that list.
This is The Media Project. I'm Ira Fussfeld with Alan Shartok, Rosemary Romeo, and Judy Patrick. Well, this is related only in that we started talking about finances. Last week on the program, we touched upon the impending death of the Vindicator, the daily newspaper in Youngstown, Ohio. And a couple of stories have sort of piggybacked off of that, not necessarily because of that, but one specifically because of it is that the community in Youngstown, Ohio, is very upset. At least I was represented at a community forum where people were crying that they were about to lose their newspaper. A journalism professor at Youngstown State saying the Vindicator connects all of us. A community without a strong central newspaper is missing leadership and a big part of its identity. I think it's a safe prediction, and we've been predicting it here for quite some time, that this is not going to be the last newspaper that folds. As I was reading about the community reaction, I kept saying to myself, where were all these people before the newspaper said it was closing?
Yep. It's like when a popular restaurant closes and people cry and come to the closeout sale, but where were they before? And also the article that I read, Margaret Sullivan wrote about it, the closing of the Vindicator, because the press is, of course, bemoaning the fate of the paper. It was a lousy newspaper, first of all. I worked in Youngstown. It was a really bad newspaper. They did not do the sort of hard-hitting investigative reporting we've just been talking about. And none of that article mentioned none of the ages of the people she talked to. I doubt that there were college-age students, for example, in there.
Well, according to the story I'm reading, and it is, in fact, Margaret Sullivan's story, the Vindicator had 44 people in the newsroom, which is significant for any newspaper that we're familiar with. But the Vindicator lost money for 20 of the past 22 years. And even at its richest in 1989, the profit margin was 17%. And I can tell you 17%, which many businesses would kill for, 17% is pretty low for the newspaper business. So that was a newspaper that was sort of just struggling along. And I'm not sure I could blame the management, the family ownership of that newspaper for shutting it down. And in fact, they did put it up for sale and didn't get any offers. So,
which, of course, Ira, brings us to the Berkshire Eagle, which we often come back to and Rex quite frequently mentions, in which, you know, one very bright judge gets a whole bunch of millionaires together and says, let's do this. Let's buy this newspaper because it's the right thing to do. And gets a lot of money behind it. You know, I wonder whether that kind of money existed in Youngstown as it did in the Berkshires, for example.
Oh, during the steel age, it certainly did. But 1989, that last profitable year, coincides with the shutdown of the steel mills. And Youngstown has been extremely depressed ever since. But it is a hub of corruption and industrial takeover.
It's a lot of good stories there.
And McAllen, Texas is another place. I went there on a training mission once, and I always had this idea, there's no money, I couldn't afford it, but to go there to live because it's right on the border of Texas and Mexico, and there's all this industrialization going on and migrant problems. It's at the heart of everything. I like the news that the nonprofits are now sending reporters, investigative reporters, into Youngstown to sort of make up for the loss in local reporting power. And I think that might be interesting, just like we ought to be doing it in McAllen, Texas.
Well, I just, maybe it's because I'm old school. I still can't round the circle in my mind about the absence of the local print newspaper and the void that will attempt to be filled by others, largely digital organizations. I, for one, still need to hold something in my hand. And I'm wondering how, if other journalists come in and other digital organizations are formed or already exist, how easy will it be for the people in the community to find that information?
I got to tell you, you know, I'm older than you are by a lot. And I have to say, I virtually never hold a newspaper in my hand anymore. You know, I'm up in the middle of the night. I read the Times. I read the Berkshire.
But do you read it on the phone or do you read it on a tablet?
I read it on the phone.
See, I can read on a tablet. I think it's comfortable. It almost feels like you're reading a newspaper. But reading on the phone, where you continue to scroll every paragraph and a half, and if you have a particularly long story, I find it tedious.
I think the discussion is misplaced. It doesn't matter where you read it. It's having the story, getting the story to put on the tablet or the phone. And that's what's lost in Youngstown. These reporters have to eat, and so they will go get other jobs. I'm hoping it'll be like Denver, where the paper shut down there, and they formed their own independent nonprofit,
Reporting. Denver is owned by my old company, and they did a massive house cleaning, although the paper still exists.
The second paper shut down.
Well, that was early, the Rocky Mountain News.
Exactly. Yeah. And they're the ones who then form their independent investigative and reporting. You know, and then the other thing that's lost is I call the Vindicator a lousy newspaper. That's because my standard is the big investigative stuff. But those reporters knew that community. If an investigator, an outsider came in and said, I want to look at X, name any subject, you can bet that there were people at that newspaper who would know the history, the context, the players, and would direct you to the right place. That knowledge is all going.
Yeah, I've been reading stories that in communities where the newspaper hasn't yet closed but has had to cut back on coverage of town boards, etc., that it has actually made the communities more expensive to live in because the town board, the politicians, feel freer to do things that they might not ordinarily have done had there been a reporter in the room covering the stories.
Right. And in fact, I think somebody's studying that someplace.
Yeah. There's another newspaper that's closing. It's perhaps less familiar to many of our readers, but it's I would hope you've heard of it. It's called the Chicago Defender. It's one of the nation's major black newspapers, and it is ceasing print editions this week, although it will continue digitally. And again, the quote from the executive, it is an economic decision, but it's more of an effort to make sure the Defender has another 100 years, meaning they'll be able to continue just doing it digitally. So, Alan, I'm going to prompt you on something. The New York Times ran an op-ed piece the other day by a guy named Howard Hussock, who is vice president for research and publications at the Manhattan Institute, bemoaning the loss of newspapers and the steady decline of coverage. Calls it a threat to democracy, but he says it's an opportunity for public media. The public media status quo doesn't adequately address the need of the $445 million distributed annually by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Some $320 million is distributed directly to local television and radio broadcasters, including for the production of local content. In practice, however, the bulk of these funds do not stay in the local community. Instead, local stations use the fund to purchase national programming and for dues to NPR and PBS. In the case of radio, some $23 million in federal funds must, by statute, be used only to support national programming. Alan, what's your experience? I know the WAMC does an extraordinary amount of local reporting and local shows like this one. Yes. I suspect that we could say it's the exception to the rule, but what do you think of this guy's idea?
Well, look, you know, I have big problems with National Public Radio, and I guess everybody sort of knows it. It was a bad deal from the beginning in terms of what the local stations had to do. Just this, our station pays almost $1 million, approaching $1 million. I think, you know, NPR does a good job, but I think NPR has the obligation to go out and find its money. Ronald Reagan didn't like NPR, so they set up a system where all the money came to the local stations, but we pay by far much more than we get to NPR. And, you know, I think that we do have to take a very careful look at the way in which all of this is working out. I don't like it. I talk to colleagues in smaller stations. We're a fairly large station. They don't like it either, but they haven't got the guts to say so. And right now, NPR has got everybody by the hair.
Wasn't this a bait-and-switch op-ed? In my mind, they're talking about the demise of local newspapers, and the next thing I know, we're talking about giving money to radio stations. Mm-hmm. It didn't address the issue about local newspapers covering local issues, although I will say that WAMC does cover local issues, but it's not the same as a local newspaper.
Well, nothing is the same. I think that we're doing just fine, Judy, and while I have great respect for you, I sort of
present
intimation here.
No, but the article starts out talking about newspapers, and I think, oh, we're going to talk about newspapers, and the next thing you know, we're talking about federal funding of radio stations.
Well, yes, but people are allowed to go where they want in these stories. Look, there's a wide landscape. There's a lot going on in terms of the collection of news. We're very proud of what happens at WAMC. You can't find a space on our wall which doesn't have an award on it for what we've been doing. So I think some of that was a little bit misplaced.
And now I interrupt this commercial for some actual content. I think the real intent of the editorial was about local news in whatever form. Again, it's not the medium, it's the content. And that has been getting the actual news has gotten harder and harder as we've changed media. And you talk, for example, if a person dies in a house on your street, the whole neighborhood is talking about that death, and rumors and information is shared about what happened and who was there and who's affected. How does that filter into a newspaper or into a radio show? We are losing more and more local news. Ira mentioned the city council meetings. Newspapers, in my day, when I started, used to routinely send reporters who had to stay late into the night during the most boring of meetings. But we knew 2 months later when there was an action taken, oh, that's related to that. Mm-hmm. You put it all together. Nobody in news is doing that anymore. And that is a loss for the citizens of this country.
Well, I don't know that that's really fair, Rosemary. I don't know that you want to be fair. But in our case, we do a lot of local stories, which we get results from people who say, hey, there was a triple murder or a double murder. We want to hear about that. We don't want to hear about what went on at City Hall. We don't want to hear about that stuff. And to which we say, tough noogies. You know, that's what we do, and we do
but
it well.
But, you know, the issue is, again, this is not to denigrate WAMC, which is an exception in many, many senses. You have bureaus around the region. You cover 8 states. But it's impossible for your reporter who might be in Springfield, Massachusetts, to cover everything going on in Springfield, Massachusetts. So by no choice of your own, you've got to decide what you're going to cover and what you're not going to cover. In the heydays of newspapers, even
each
newspapers
community
couldn't cover everything, but they covered a hell of a lot more than they're covering now. So,
well, get me my violin, Ira. That is over now.
Well, it is over, but radio
and
stations...
And I'll play Hearts and Flowers for you.
But
it's not that it's over. I mean, we routinely in this country see businesses close or change because of economic reasons. The problem is, I don't see a replacement. Where's the hyper news going now, the hyper local news, or the big major foreign news? Where do people get this? They're not getting it.
The weekly newspapers are doing a good job, but I don't know what kind of financial footing they're on either.
And in fact, people at weekly papers or a lot of the dailies are still going to those boring meetings, and they're staying until 11 or 12 o'clock and filing late. It's still happening. It's just that there are a lot of communities that it's not happening. And in defense of all of us, I'd say in every city, in every small town, there are 1,000 stories to cover every single day.
Yes.
And we all have to make decisions about which ones to cover, and more importantly, which ones not to cover.
But, you know, nature abhors a vacuum. In my little town of Great Barrington, Massachusetts, there's one woman who decided she was going to make a little paper. She goes to every single meeting, and it goes out. You pay $35, and you know everything that's going on. Now, that's just one example of nature and a vacuum, because she's decided everybody has to know everything.
You've made her a star on this program.
Well, yes.
That's pretty cool, actually.
Let me
hobbyist.
I want to tap Rosemary's knowledge again on worldwide journalism. A lot of people in our industry in this country believe that we, the media, are under attack by the government and by people who want to block us or make it more difficult for us to get information. I've been reading more and more about Australia, a place where you wouldn't think this would be a problem. But in fact, the most recent case is the Australian Federal Police obtained from Qantas Airways the personal travel records of a journalist, a revelation that alarmed the media industry after police raids on journalists last month raised questions about press freedoms in the country. The feeling is that journalism is under attack in this country, said a media representative. There is no regard for the important role journalists play in functioning democracy. Is this a creeping trend that you're seeing around the world?
No, it isn't creeping. America has long been an island where this didn't happen, mostly because of the First Amendment, the most important, in my mind, guarantee of freedom in the world. And Australia doesn't have something similar. Most places don't. So I've been working in the Middle East. This would be routine. The airline is owned by the government. It would be no problem. I actually believe that Trump is sending out signals that this is okay in other Western democracies. If he can get away with it in the United States where there's constitutional protection, why not here? Nobody in government really is going to love the press. They don't want to be scrutinized. You can understand that. But they've tolerated it up to now, and you're seeing more and more reports. Australia just had an incident where the police went banging on the door of a freelancer or a, you know, an independent investigator. He wasn't connected with the large outlet. I mean, that was absolutely a violation of what in our country would be illegal search and seizure. And they did it without any kind of consequences in Australia. So, yeah, I hope the journalists there are as alert as we are in the United States to what is happening.
Well, this executive of the Australian Union for Journalists, Paul Murphy, said the incident was another sign that it had become normal practice for the federal police and law enforcement agencies in Australia to target journalists and whistleblowers. We need urgent action from government to protect the right to know. I'm not sure how willing government is
to
help.
Yeah,
right.
Not.
I think that the society in Austria does not have the same expectation that there should be the free flow of information. The courts are notoriously closed in Australia.
Yeah.
Well, in our final minutes, let's get back to Trump. It's hard to do a program about anything without talking about Trump. And Marty Baron, the editor of The Washington Post, gave a speech the other day in which he reiterated something that he and others, including us on this program, have said for a long time, and that is that Trump's use of the word fake news and his use of the phrase enemy of the people and his constant media bashing is not just some whimsical, crazed Trump reaction to what he sees on television or on in newspapers, but a cynical strategy to disqualify the press as an independent arbiter of fact. It's a strategy that he believes the more he can convince his base and others that what people say about him is untrue, the more likely it is that they will disbelieve pretty much everything that's in the media. You agree that it's a strategy?
I have a hard time seeing Trump having a strategy about anything. I think he hit on this in the same way that he hit on the discontent in the Midwest and realized that he was getting a reaction and kept going for it more.
I don't agree with you, Rosemary. I think he had a strategy. I think this guy is a pre-totalitarian, pre-fascist, and one of the first things you do is get rid of the press, and I think he knew it from first moment, and to some degree, with his people, it's working.
Yeah, well, he said as much to Leslie Stahl early in his tenure. If you keep on saying it, that people will discredit him. I mean, he worked the press to great success, but long before he became president. It is hard to believe that it's a true strategy.
I know.
He's just not.
I know. One third of the American people, however, to Judy's point, believe the press is the enemy of the people.
To quote Mr. Welch, he has no shame.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? He's a little bit angry at his friends at Fox News. He watches Fox News all the time, and when he watches on the weekend, he says watching it on the weekend is worse than watching CNN and MSNBC. he's complaining that Fox is loading up with Democrats, including Donna Brazile, the former Democratic committee chair. And he said, interestingly, Fox News is changing fast, but they forgot the people who got them there.
You know, I think he needs to limit his screen time.
Well, would we rather he be spending the weekend watching Fox or playing golf?
We should do a whole story on Fox, because I think some of the things that Fox does is to bring some liberals on, but often they are not the strongest of the liberal people who could counter what the others are saying.
There's a big difference between Fox News and Fox Opinion, and Trump likes the opinion leaders because they're all solidly behind
him. Well, if you're not watching the series The Loudest Voice on Showtime, I urge you to pick it up. I'll tell Rosemary about it because she's never heard of it. I'll tell you about it if I'm allowed back in the studio again. But that's it for this week.
Oh, I don't know.
That's it for this week on The Media Project. I'm Ira Fussfeld with Rosemary Romeo, Alan Shartok, and Judy Patrick. Thanks for listening.